It's episode 3 of An Incomplete History. Today we'll be discussing impeachment. Additionally, we'll talk about how do you teach difficult, sometimes politically charged topics in the classroom. Join us today on An Incomplete History. Hello and welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
We're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
Well, so last week we had a little reprieve. We talked about witches, and that's not very controversial anymore, I guess. This week, however, we're back to controversial topics. We're going to be talking about impeachment today. What do you think about that, Hillary?
Well, I told you I was excited about this episode because I love being able to talk about things that are relevant to right now, especially in the classroom. And I told you I've been covering the 1790s a couple weeks back in class, and I just kept seeing so many overlapping things. So I was excited to get into a discussion about the historical aspects of impeachment and what the kind of the mindset was for the framers at that moment.
Right. I mean, we kind of made a decision when we decided to do this podcast. We're going to shy away from controversial topics, right? And we're going to kind of approach them asking hard questions.
Well, I think that we're confronting them head on, but not with our own opinions on it, but just kind of giving contextual historical basis for them. Is that fair?
Right. Right. Definitely. I mean, there's the whole thing of, you want my opinion on current events, get me a beer and we can sit down and discuss that. But I mean, we are giving context, right? I mean, what we want to do here is provide context for the impeachment discussion. Because I hear bad information given out by multiple parties right now about what the country's relationship with impeachment has been, how it is or isn't in the Constitution, what's clarified. I've heard a lot of bad information out there, and hopefully our little podcast can do its part to kind of dispel some of that and like talk about, no, here's actually what's in the Constitution. Here's what's happened in the past.
Yeah, so, I think that that's exciting. So we didn't even have any small talk. We just jumped right in.
Well, I have a sneaking suspicion this conversation is going to go pretty long. I mean, I do want to know, how you doing? You said you were a little chilly there.
Yeah, so I've been complaining all last week about how hot it was, and then all of a sudden it got cold, and I don't really know what to do with myself. And
welcome to the South.
Shivering. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's how it goes.
I mean, I don't want this to be like a weather podcast, but man, there's always some sort of weather situation occurring here in Mississippi. So,
well, but I mean, in the future, when historians discover our podcast and wonder what the hell is this, I mean, don't you like it when you find historical sources and they have like notes about the weather or something?
If it's relevant, I think it's great.
I like it when it's irrelevant. I think it's so, it just gets such an interesting window into what's going on. I mean, especially the words they use to describe weather and stuff.
Yeah.
A freshet.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a freshet right now. It's 44 degrees, so.
Is it raining?
It's not.
Well, then it's not a freshet, right?
I don't know what a freshet is.
it's some kind of rain.
Chilly. It sounds chilly.
Well, it does, but I think it's some kind of rain thing. Well, maybe we'll have an episode where we talk about colonial weather or something. Anyway, so let's talk about impeachment. So let's talk about how it gets in the Constitution.
Okay.
First.
Well, I covered a little bit about this in my class, but kind of figuring into a more deep dive of what we're talking about here is it comes as a part of the Constitution when they are, you know, reframing how they want the country to look, right? So in the wake of the Articles of Confederation, like these loosely based state entities, they want a stronger federal government. But what they are so afraid of is monarchy. They're afraid of aristocracy. They really want to get away from that. And so the way that they frame it, so they feel better, I guess, about instilling somebody in an executive branch is to split the branches of government, right? And this is like social science 101. This is something we learn from the time we're young in schools about the three separate branches of government. And where it stems from is in this moment of true fear over turning into something like a monarchy, where there's some person who's in supreme power and that power goes unchecked. So there's a debate that starts to happen, and they decide in Article 2, Section 4, that there should be an impeachment clause. And they settle on the language of treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors. And we hear this discussion of high crimes and misdemeanors all the time. And what does that mean is kind of what we'll get into a little bit today. But there was a debate at the time over, should it be called high crimes and misdemeanors, or should we call it maladministration?
Right.
So Madison fights against that, right? We're not going to
Mason's involved in it too, right? James Mason.
Yeah, but Madison's the one who goes forth and says, we need an impeachment clause, because it's Rufus King who's saying, no, we do not need an impeachment clause in the Constitution, because the potential for somebody taking over government or abusing power, that will be checked by the people themselves every 4 years. So Rufus King argues, we don't actually need this because elections themselves will decide whether or not somebody is going to stay in office. And Madison really, really comes out against us and says, no, the country could be ruined within a year. We can't have that in, we can't leave that to chance. There needs to be a system in place where we can try the executive for what they end up settling on, the language of treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors. And so the debate over just what language should be used is one part of it, but then also whether or not the other branches of government should be even responsible for checking the executive.
Right. I mean, Rufus King has that great thing he says, where he says, what the executive would be periodically tried for his behavior by his electors.
Right, right. And that's the whole idea is like, well, no, we're trying to make a democracy. And so that should go back, like the power should go to the people to decide that.
Right. But I mean, this has an even older history, right?
Yeah, it does. It goes all the way back to British constitutional history. And this language, this late language of high crimes and misdemeanors, it was a well understood terminology to people in that era, because this goes back to 14th century parliamentary rule, right?
So is that why we don't have a definition of the Constitution? Because everybody just said, well, we don't need to define this. We all know what this means.
Yeah, I would say for sure, because it's something that they had been well aware of, because it's so part of British parliamentary law. And they were using it in British Parliament to hold the king's ministers accountable for their public behavior. And that, right, that was kind of the idea, is like, people who are representing the public should behave in a certain way. And if we feel they're not, we have the power to admonish them. And what's important about this, and what's important in this discussion of impeachment, it is a political act. It is to slap somebody on the hand for not acting right. It's not about breaking the law, though it's not mutually exclusive, right? Somebody who is breaking the law could be impeached. But it's not steeped in a legal sense. It's more about, again, being upset with somebody who's not acting right as a public servant.
Right. So Alexander Hamilton, he's a Federalist, and the Federalist Papers, I love to go back to the Federalist Papers. I think they're such a great window into kind of political discourse. And as you get this group that's really trying to convince ratification of the Constitution, groups to ratify it. The interesting thing, kind of researching as we got into this episode, if you had asked me before I researched whether I thought Hamilton was for or against impeachment, I would have said against.
Why?
What about you? I don't know.
I would say for because he is a Federalist and he is in favor of a strong central federal government. And I would say one of the strengths of the government is the ability to have checks and balances, where an anti-federalist is more about like sending that over to the people or the states or something along those lines.
Right.
But
I don't, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, once I read it, I was like, oh, this makes sense. I would have assumed the anti-federalist would have been much more in support of, okay, we've got to have this constitution and this big government, fine. Let's put some safety measures into it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if we get some leader who aspires to be a despot, we can get them out.
Well, at the end of the day, you have bipartisan support on this.
Right.
Right.
I mean, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so the Constitution, it says the president, vice president, and others, and all civil officers of the United States. So the interesting thing with that, and we can talk about this a little bit when we talk about how impeachment's played out, this includes judges.
Yeah, well, and that's actually who's historically been impeached. That judges have more so been impeached because presidents have gone through an impeachment process, but it's never actually gone through the full process, right, of being confirmed in the Senate. But judges have. And it makes sense, a lot of sense with judges, because we're talking a lifetime appointment.
Right.
And so judges have been impeached.
I mean, it's interesting. So theoretically, a Supreme Court justice could be impeached.
Yeah, theoretically.
Theoretically.
Federal judges are.
Right. That's the thing is we've seen a lot of federal judges. I mean, that's the thing is there's only a handful of presidents who have faced impeachment or even the prospect of impeachment. But there's a lot of other officials, particularly judges, right?
Right. When they're talking really quickly, though, when they're talking about when they're having a debate over this, right, the Federalist Papers allow for an extension of the debate, so to speak. And you get several moments in the Federalist Papers where they're discussing what is the importance of maintaining a level of honesty, I suppose, amongst the executive branch. And they are trying to instill these protections. And when you get really down into the nitty-gritty of a discussion about why they think that this is important, it's about maintaining a sense of honor, civility, and honesty in government. And Federalist 65, they go into this a little bit. It's about the abuse of the public, right? So like violation of public trust. This is an impeachable offense, to violate the public's trust. And so again, this has nothing to do with necessarily breaking the law, but it has more to do with just abuse of power. And this mindset is so important to understand in the late 18th century, because they are fearful, again, of aristocracy. They're fearful of monarchy. As an extension of this, they are also afraid of foreign interference in their new government. And so a lot of the debate and the questioning over impeachment and about the abuse of public trust oftentimes boils down to communication with or help from foreign powers, because you have to remember how at this nascent moment in history of the United States' history, it's incredibly fragile. And they are afraid of interference of other larger powers. And they're afraid of the corruption of their elected officials as a result of that. And they're afraid of, just this incredibly fragile system, that it's going to be disrupted. And so they want to be able to put these in place.
Right. So Article 1, Section 2 says the House of Representatives shall choose, C-H-U-S-E, I love that, their speaker and other officers, and shall have the sole power of impeachment. And then Article 1, Section 3 goes on, the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. And it clarifies, when the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. Is the Constitution pretty clear about who prosecutes impeachment and who tries impeachment and what has to happen for it to actually stick?
Well, I think what you just laid out, it makes it sound really clear in policy, but in practice, it gets a little muddier, right?
Well, and I think that's the thing is it's something we use so rarely that I think people forget the language of the Constitution is fairly straightforward about it. There's a lot of things I think we wish it would define a little more carefully. But look, if you're looking for deep definitions of words, don't look to the Constitution, right? I mean,
no, and they're intentional about that. In one way,
are they?
Yeah, well,
I
that's
know.
What the debate is about. Right, is they wanted to have maladministration. And Madison says, no, that's too vague. And so they settle on high crimes and misdemeanors because they find that to not be vague. And again, that goes back to this was just common vernacular, basically. And to us, it sounds incredibly foreign. But to them, it's not because they were used to this parliamentary system in there were people who were officials accused of high crimes and misdemeanors who were accused of offenses that varied from misappropriation of government funds, not spending money properly allocated by parliament, promoting themselves ahead of other candidates. Right? I mean, there was all kinds of things that people in parliament were admonished for, and it was certain behaviors. So I think they thought they were being pretty clear with their language. But mm-hmm. to us, it seems obtuse.
I mean, it does, but it doesn't. I mean, it's can the president be tried for impeachment? Yes. I mean, it says the president can.
Well, that's what it's for.
Right. Who, yeah. I mean, who prosecutes it? The House of Representatives. Who tries it? The Senate.
Are people even debating that part of it? I don't know. I mean, it's...
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people I hear kind of journalists and commentators, kind of talking heads discussing impeachment today, they want to find wiggle room and things. And, you know, I think there's wiggle room on, well, what does high crimes and misdemeanors mean? What exactly, you know, what's the process? The process isn't spelled out at all. It's just the House prosecutes, the Senate kind of tries it with the Chief Justice sitting over everything. I find it interesting, Article 1, Section 3, Part 7. It says the most you can do, though, for impeachment is remove somebody from office and disqualify them from holding and enjoying office of honor, trust, or profit again.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, worst case scenarios, I mean, say you had a president who just kind of invited a foreign military in to take over our country or something, the Senate could not constitutionally try and convict that president through impeachment and then convict that president to anything worse than just removing the president from office, which I find interesting. And I think it plays back to your comment about this is political, right? I mean, the impeachment process is a political process. It's not
it
a legal process.
It doesn't say, though, it doesn't say that after impeachment that the person who was impeached is completely free from legal consequences.
Oh, no, it says they
right?
can be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, punishment according to law. But it's the Senate is not going to do it as part of impeachment, right? Mm. So... something else I found out this week. I mean, it's interesting. There's a lot I found out reading about this. I thought I had read a lot about impeachment, but there's a lot I didn't know. I mean, who's the first person where there's an impeachment attempt? The first president. Do you know this?
That there's an attempted impeachment? Was it Adams?
Uh-huh. No.
No? Okay, I don't know then.
It's John Tyler, 1843.
Oh, okay.
So William Henry Harrison died suddenly. April 1841, like a month after he was sworn in as president of the United States. And Tyler becomes the first vice president to become president because the president died. Mm-hmm. And the impeachment proceeding is put out there basically because they're saying, you're not really the president. You're just kind of holding, you're keeping the seat warm so we can actually get another president. You need to step down so we can get a new president. Now, they also disagreed on some stuff. The people who, the kind of representatives who supported the articles of impeachment or kind of starting impeachment said that Tyler didn't understand what was going on in the West. And he was kind of undermining some of Harrison's campaign promises. And Tyler exercised the veto a few times, especially with the bank bill. And that's when they kind of move forward to try to impeach him. And it's funny. So the articles of impeachment or the impeachment request gets put in. They want a resolution requesting he resign from office. And that if he doesn't, then pray that he may be impeached on the grounds of his ignorance of the interest and true policy of the government and want of qualification for the discharge of important duties of the President of the United States. So, you know, it gets dismissed relatively rapidly. And I think it's pretty clear. I mean, it's, you know, other people in the House recognized, you know, this doesn't meet the Constitution's definition.
Well, and in the 19th century, from my understanding of it, it is a really a political act. It's a political admonishment of, we don't like the way you're behaving.
Right.
And it doesn't really shake out to anything that is treasonous or misdemeanor, high crimes, whatever, right? Like, none of the things really shake out to that. And it more is just a, we're checking you because we don't like the way you're acting. I mean, even arguably Johnson's the worst president, right?
But let's talk about Johnson, because he's the one, I think he's a real good example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, right? Where it's sheerly a political act. So go ahead and cover Johnson.
Well, so Andrew Johnson, much like Tyler, becomes president because the president dies. For Tyler, it was William Henry Harrison. And for Johnson, it's Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. And Johnson was an interesting choice for vice president because he was from Tennessee. And remember, that presidential election takes place in the Civil War.
He's trying to bridge the gap, right? Lincoln's really interested in bridging the gap. And wanted to bring in somebody from the South to try to help. I mean, even though he's one of the senators who doesn't side with secessionists, right?
Right, right. I mean, that's the interesting thing is Johnson is able to kind of participate in government so quickly because he wasn't a secessionist. And when Tennessee's brought back into the Union, he's able to become their senator or he's able to become a political agent kind of again because of that status. So he becomes vice president for Lincoln. And Lincoln, it gets into a whole other thing that I think's outside kind of the purview of this episode. But Lincoln, it seems, had a certain vision for Reconstruction. And there were other elements of the Republican Party, which was still a very young party at this point, that disagreed fundamentally with Lincoln. Now, remember, Lincoln is a Republican. Mm-hmm. But the radical Republicans, as we call them now, really wanted to punish the South, right?
Right. They wanted radical Reconstruction. Like Thaddeus Stevens, you know, was very much in favor of an occupation of the South, and Lincoln wasn't there.
So Lincoln disillusioned them somewhat when he picks Johnson, because Johnson's a Union Democrat, right? And the interesting thing is this, is ultimately Johnson gets in trouble because Congress passes this thing called the Tenure of Office Act, and then Johnson vetoes that. The House and the Senate override it, And then they actually issue articles of impeachment against Johnson because he violates the Tenure of Office Act, which was Stanton, right? He fired Stanton as his Secretary of War. And I find that really interesting because it's so political, right? It's being pushed by radical Republicans. It's so political. I mean, does Johnson commit high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, no. I mean, and I think that that's the whole point is like, it is being used at this point as a political tool.
Here's the thing. So impeachment inquiry happens February 25th, 1868. The House tells the Senate, hey, yesterday evening, we voted 126 to 47 to impeach Johnson. And they send it to the Senate. And through March, April, and May, you know, it's tried in the Senate. So Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase presides. And Johnson appears and chooses not to appear at trial. Through March, April, and to the end of May, this trial proceeds. And eventually, the Senate acquits him of everything, right?
Right.
And May 26, 1868, I mean, the Senate acquits Johnson and adjourns impeachment. Now, is Johnson impeached?
So this is an important distinction. Yes, he's impeached by the House, but there's two parts of this process that need to play out in order for removal to take place. You can be impeached, but that doesn't mean that you've been removed.
Let's talk about the guy, you know, I really want to talk about because I'm fascinated by it. As a little boy, I remember my parents watching Richard Nixon's Senate's investigation into Richard Nixon. And I was just fascinated by it. And, you know, I love the story of it. It's so complicated. And I think it's useful to kind of discuss Nixon because, again, most people misunderstand why Nixon leaves office. Now, people know he resigns. But I think
that's an important distinction to make. Nixon was not impeached, right?
So. Right. He's not impeached at all. You know, I'll kind of talk about that in a minute. He's not impeached at all. It looks like impeachment's going to happen, but it doesn't happen before he resigns. So, I mean, Nixon, I think what's really important is to understand with Nixon is this. So, Richard Nixon's a complicated guy. Was Quaker. He came from kind of a modest background in Yorba Linda, California, Southern California, but not kind of a super swanky part of Southern California. He was Dwight Eisenhower's vice president through the 50s. And in 1960, he runs against John F. Kennedy. And something interesting is Nixon and Kennedy were both junior senators at the same time. They both entered the Senate at the same time. And they knew each other. And Nixon, not the most attractive guy. Kennedy was very kind of photogenic. It is the closest presidential election, popular vote-wise. Nixon loses to Kennedy by 120,000 popular votes. But the electoral margin's much larger, but 120,000 votes is all that separated the two of them. Now, I know some people are going to say, yeah, but 2016. I'm talking in the past. I'm not talking about 2016 and stuff like that. 120,000 votes. It's the closest, right? No other presidential election in the modern era has been decided with that little difference in popular vote, which I think is really interesting. And, you know, some people who've done biographies of Nixon say this puts a chip on his shoulder. And this may play out later. So in 1968, he gets elected president. Lyndon Johnson famously announces he's not going to run for re-election. Nixon sees this as an opportunity. He runs for president, gets elected, really solid win. In 72, he runs for re-election. Overwhelming win. But in that interim, and it might be interesting to mention this, that 72 election, it's the largest plurality of votes in American history.
Yet
that
you have can't ever voted find for anybody who voted for Nixon today, if you ask them.
Well, that's the joke, right? It's like, who voted for Nixon? I didn't vote for Nixon. It's the largest plurality in history. So already, though, there were things going on. So June 17th, 1972, back the summer before the election in November of that year, there were a group of men arrested at 2:30 a.m. at the Watergate building complex at the Democratic National Committee offices. And these men were in possession of things like walkie-talkies, wire devices. They had burgled their way into the office. And over that summer, it's really two Washington Post reporters who kind of pick this up, and they carry it for a long time. Woodward and Bernstein, right? And Woodward starts to kind of draw connections here. And I have to say this, I don't show movies often in the classroom, but to get this like investigation part down, I have my students watch All the President's Men, which is made pretty close to when this happens, only a few years after all this happens. And it's a really good example. It's a really good narrative of what happens and who does what. But eventually, Nixon and kind of close advisors try to cover up their connection with these men who had broken in. And it's the cover-up that becomes the problem. In July of 73, so this is after Nixon's been elected for a second term, Alexander Butterfield, he's the presidential appointment secretary, reveals that all conversations and telephone calls in the office have been taped since 71. So immediately the Senate Watergate Committee says, we need to see these tapes. We need to listen to them. And Nixon refuses to turn them over. And this kind of creates a constitutional crisis. October 20th is this famous Saturday Night Massacre. So this new prosecutor, Archibald Cox, independent special prosecutor, had been brought in by the DOJ. And Nixon orders Elliot Richardson and then Ruckelshaus, both officials in the DOJ, to fire him. They both refused and resigned. And finally, Robert Bork, who comes up later in U.S. history during the Reagan administration, he considers resigning, but ultimately carries out the order. And Leon Jaworski is appointed the new special prosecutor. So now things start to move quickly. Eventually, indictments are issued against some presidential aides. Special Prosecutor Jaworski, and remember, this is the one who had been appointed after Cox, who was seen as such a problem, has been fired. Jaworski in April 16th, 1974. And you can kind of see how long this process takes, right? I mean, we're 2 years after the break-in. Jaworski requests the tapes, 64 of them. And the White House gives transcripts, but they're edited. And the House Judiciary Committee at this point says, no, we need the actual tapes. So May 9th, 1974, impeachment hearings begin before the House Judiciary Committee. July 15th, just a month later, Woodward and Bernstein's book, All the President's Men, comes out. And then finally, July of that year, July 24th, 1974, the United States versus Nixon is decided. So this is Nixon versus Congress, basically. Do they have the right to make Nixon turn over these tapes? And Nixon is ordered to give up the tapes. Now, evidently, there was a moment after the Supreme Court ruled where people didn't know, what do we do if Nixon just ignores the Supreme Court?
This is relevant to right now. Right.
I think it is. And I think a lot of people held their breath.
Well, and that's, I keep hearing people say constitutional crisis. And I think that this is what they're referring to. So when in the Nixon era, we didn't have to worry about this because Nixon resigned. So that's what's important to take away from this is like the impeachment proceedings didn't even need to come to completion because right. he leaves office. What's happening right now is not similar in the sense that we're not seeing cooperation on behalf of the executive branch for this investigation. And there's no sign whatsoever that there's going to be a resignation. And so that's right. why I keep hearing this phrase of constitutional crisis. And it never came to that with Nixon, although there was fear of it, but he believed.
Well, I mean, so the House Judiciary Committee does pass articles of impeachment to send to the broader House of Representatives to vote on. And this is at the end of July, 1974. And in August, kind of before the House can kind of move on that, right, the beginning of August, several Republican senators contact Nixon and say, look, there are enough votes to impeach you.
Right. And so,
like, if this thing comes to the Senate, you're going to be impeached. Mm-hmm. So Nixon, August 8th, 1974, resigns. And then August 9th, Gerald Ford becomes president. And then September 8th, less than a month later, Ford gives Nixon a pardon. And, you know, it's, we kind of move on from that. I mean, there's repercussions here. There's the Privacy Act of 74 and some other things that come out of this. But, you know, Nixon was not impeached. The House never voted on impeachment. The Senate was never given an impeachment recommendation by the House that they needed to try, unlike Bill Clinton.
Right.
Right.
Who was impeached.
He was impeached, right? Yes, he was. So Bill Clinton was impeached, and it's mainly came down to him lying, right?
Right. Well, but see, again, to be clear, he was impeached in the House, but it doesn't make it through the Senate, right? There's no president right. who's ever been impeached and gone through the entire process of being impeached and removed. Right. So that's important. It's like we have a podcast today to talk about something that's never actually happened,
right? Well, that's the thing. And I think people think it's happened, right? I think when they hear impeached, they think removed from office.
Yeah. And that's, and
they know
clear. That's not, I mean, you can be impeached, but not removed, right?
Right. And they don't understand that Johnson just fails to be reelected, mm-hmm. that, you know, Nixon resigns,
and
that Clinton couldn't get reelected.
Yeah, Clinton's term expires.
Right. So we are kind of in uncharted water.
We're in uncharted territory. Absolutely.
So, I mean, I think this is important to talk about. The Constitution kind of has some guidelines and where we'd like there to be a little more specific language, but it doesn't exist. You know, have we been quick to try to impeach presidents? If you had to like give a pronouncement.
No, in fact, I think we've never been quick enough. I mean, think of some heinous things that presidents have done historically that there was never any call for any form of impeachment. I mean, it is
What about Andrew Jackson when he tells the Supreme Court, you've made your ruling, but you don't have an army to enforce it?
But he wasn't impeached.
No, I know he wasn't
That's
impeached.
What I'm but saying. I mean, we've not been quick enough.
Right. I mean, that seems pretty questionable behavior.
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying is like, there's been so many moments of really questionable behavior. Jackson, I mean, Adams, that's why when you asked me, I thought, well, Adams, the Alien and Sedition Acts. I mean, that's nuts. Lincoln suspends habeas corpus. We have mm-hmm. FDR who has Executive Order 9066 where he removes Japanese Americans to concentration camps.
Right.
I mean, some of the things that U.S. presidents have done are heinous acts against right. the best interest of the people. But because most of these things are done during times of turbulence or war, so the Alien Sedition Acts, it's during the quasi-war with France. With Jackson, there's incredible turmoil on the frontier. Of course, during, you know, the suspension of habeas corpus is in the midst of the Civil War, 1863. And with FDR, you have right in the midst of World War II and in the wake of Pearl Harbor. So it's like the presidents have taken extreme action that is very much against the interests of the people in some cases, and nothing's been done about it at all. And so if you think about impeachment as a political act, it often is that. I mean, because I think what's going on right now is heinous, but it's mm-hmm. because it's not happening in a time of war. The House is led by the opposition party, right? So there is going to be more support for going after the actions of a president. Now, the reason it's not going to get passed in the Senate, of course, is because it's Republican led. But I think we've not been quick enough historically to invoke articles of impeachment, you know, against presidents who are completely out of control with their power. I think that the House and the checks and balances on the government, I think they are doing their job right now. It is their mm-hmm. job. Whether he's found guilty or not, or impeached or removed or not, they are literally doing their job by checking on this situation. Mm-hmm. That's what the checks and balances are for. It's for other branches of government to go, hey, what's the executive branch doing? Let's look into it. And it is the law, it's in the Constitution that the president and the executive branch must comply with the investigation.
Right.
And Lindsey Graham famously says that about Clinton.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that impeachment might be one of those things we haven't really used it in the past, maybe as quickly or forcefully as we should have. So we look and say, well, we haven't used it in the past, therefore we shouldn't use it now either.
Disagree, right?
Right. But I think that's a rationale some people use is like, look, we've been real careful in the past. This maybe doesn't meet that threshold. But I mean, it's there. It's in the Constitution. It's the word impeachment is actually used. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's rarely does the Constitution use specific language like that, but it is. I mean, I kind of wonder what would have happened if kind of Hamilton's public trust, if something like that or something like that, what was the term you said Mason used?
The maladministration.
Maladministration. I wonder if something like that had appeared in the Constitution, if this would have been used more often.
I mean, I think it would have, maybe. But also, I mean, I don't think this has to be a Republican or Democrat. This doesn't have to come down to political parties. It has to come down to just what are the jobs of these different branches of government? And if right. their job is to check each other, then they're just doing their job. And if it right. hasn't been used in the past, well, that's a shame, right? I mean, we can't say, well, it hasn't been used in the past, so we're not going to do it now. No, they're doing their job. And if right. there's nothing that was wrong that happened, and there was no high crime or misdemeanor, there was no misappropriation of power or funds or nothing corrupt, then there should be no hesitation on behalf of the executive branch to fully cooperate with this investigation. Right. None whatsoever. Because if the investigation is carried out and there's nothing is found, then nothing's found and we move on. But it's so important, and this is with the constitutional crisis aspect. It's like, if the executive branch fails to cooperate, that is the crisis. Because that right. is what's written in the Constitution. It's like, it is the job of each of these branches to behave and conduct themselves in these ways. And if one branch fails to comply with that, as Lindsey Graham said in 1996, I believe, that in and of itself is an impeachable offense. And he said right. yesterday, on the 16th of October, I believe, nothing's changed. Lindsey Graham said that.
Right.
Incredible. Yeah.
So, I mean, how do you deal with issues like this in the classroom? Let's kind of wrap our conversation up there. Because, you know, we're both educators. How do you deal with a topic like this in the classroom without alienating students who may politically completely disagree with things you're saying?
Well, I mean, kind of like I just did right now, and I truly believe this. Like, I don't think it has to be partisan. I don't think it has to come down to whether you do or do not support the president. It's do you or do you not support the founding documents of this country? And if you support the Constitution, which so many people like to flout as their, you know, like their second Bible, if you believe in the Constitution, if you believe in the founding principles of this nation, then you believe that this is an inquiry that's worthy of pursuit. That you would believe that this is entirely legitimate, you know, questioning that's happening here. And you would think that this is a normal exercise of government, right? And so I would invite students to tell me otherwise, right? And I don't mean that in a confrontational way, but just tell me why you think otherwise. And I'm sure I would get responses that were just wholly in support of, you know, saying that, well, this is just a witch hunt, going back to what we talked about last week about witches, right? And that term, that terminology. But if it's a witch hunt, I mean, won't that shake out in the end? I don't know.
I mean, that was Hamilton's defense for if you're worried about this being misused, right?
Right. And that is, I mean, you know what? It could be being misused. If it is a political stunt, maybe it is being misused. But at the end of the day, the evidence just simply wouldn't be there.
Right.
And that's where I think we have to trust the process. It's ugly. Right. It's divisive. I think that it is causing an incredible amount of tension in this country. I think that it's going to boil over at some point in some way. But there, people are doing their jobs here. And if there's nothing to be seen and there's no evidence to be heard, then the truth shall set you free, right? I mean, then you shouldn't be afraid of the process. You should welcome the process. If you're innocent, if I were being accused of a crime and I were innocent, I'd be like, please investigate it so that way you can prove I didn't do it.
Right. Well, ever the optimist, Hillary, there with your this is gonna boil over. I would encourage
Mississippi, Jeff. Like,
I know. I would encourage educators, people teaching, both in higher ed and kind of K-12. If the topic comes up, don't shy away from it, right? I mean, civics really isn't taught anymore in schools. The public at large doesn't really understand how government functions. They have kind of a lot of misinformation floating out and about. Historians, we have an opportunity to kind of go back to where things are and say, look, this is what the Constitution says. This is what's happened. And don't shy away from it just because you're afraid you might ruffle a few feathers in the classroom.
Yeah. And it's, again, for me, it's just, it has, for me, really, honestly, it has nothing to do with political affiliation. I don't see it in that way at all. And as a historian, I see it as just an exercise in how the country was designed. And to just talk about it without getting amped about your political affiliation and just having a legitimately intellectual exchange about it, it shouldn't get heated, you know? I mean,
right.
It just doesn't make sense for it to get heated when you're just talking straight facts about this is what the Constitution says, this is what the Constitution doesn't say, right? And that way you can, I think, come to an understanding. And that doesn't mean, you know, you walk out of the classroom and you can put your, you know, you can still have a political affiliation or opinion, but to be able to just discuss it from a historical perspective and set aside any emotion that you feel toward it, I think you can have a productive discussion.
Right. Excellent. Well said. Well, I think that's about all our time for today. Thank you very much for joining us. I'd like to thank Hillary for all the great research she did, getting ready to kind of plumb the depths of impeachment. Those of you who are Watergate fans will understand that reference. Get it? Plumbers. Pretty witty. So producing a podcast and providing new content every week isn't cheap. We've added a Patreon link on our website at unincompletehistory.com. Clicking on that link takes you to our Patreon page. You can pledge to support our show with as little as $1. When you commit to $5, we'll reward you with exclusive access to material we couldn't include in the main podcast. Additionally, if you pledge at $5 or more before the end of October, we'll see you in a nifty vinyl sticker featuring our show's logo. Watch for other promos in the future. If you can't support us financially at this time, no worries, but we'd ask you to make sure you rate and review our show wherever you found us, and remember to recommend us to your friends, family, and colleagues. Be sure to join us every week for new episodes. You can subscribe through iTunes or wherever you manage to locate this podcast, as well as through our own website. The website is unincompletehistory.com. Everybody can post comments or questions on the website. If your question is something you'd like answered and it's relevant to an episode we do in the future, we'll definitely address that. We'll try to do our best to do that. Once again, I'm Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.
We'd like to wish you well. Until next time.
Thanks for joining.